Yeah, bringing in the light, been in the darkness for too long. Yeah, bringing in the light, bringing in the light by the way of the song. It's the love that gives, turns to happiness. Bringing in the joy, bringing in the light, bringing in the bliss. I'm dropping the worry, I'm dropping the shame, I'm dropping the guilt, I'm dropping the blame. I'm dropping the walls, I'm dropping the windows, dropping the doors. I'm dropping who's wrong, I'm dropping who's right, I'm dropping my put 'em up and fight. I'm dropping the roof, I'm dropping the porch, I'm dropping the floors. And I'm bringing in the light, been in the darkness for too long. Yeah, I'm bringing in the light, bringing in the light by the way of the song. It's the love again.
Well, good evening and welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. That cut opening tonight's show is one of my newer artists, Celia, and it's called Bringing in the Light. Well, I wonder if you heard my retelling of my experience on summer solstice at the Goddess Temple of Orange County in Irvine, California, when the newly installed larger-than-life statue of the Egyptian lion-headed goddess Sekhmet was consecrated and witnessed by a packed house of men and women on hand to welcome her to her temporary home. Well, if you did hear, you already know, but if you didn't, let me tell you, magic was in the air. When the big reveal of her statue happened, honest to goddess, smoke alarms went off and the lights began to flicker. Most had no doubt about Sekhmet and if she was in the building or not. So be sure to listen to last week's show for the details. It's the one on Christian mysticism with Carl McColeman. And I want to take a moment to ask my listeners for their prayers. In fact, if you have an altar, please put Lane Redman's name on it. Recently, she was on the show, and in fact, she's been on the show several times. And I invite you to listen to our conversations from the archives because her research is so rich. But she is ill, and let me read you the words of Ava, center holder and foundress of the Goddess Temple in Orange County, because they certainly mirror my own. The famed drummer, teacher, and mythologist whose music I often play at the temple is in hospice. She's had cancer since 2008, and it has spread to her lungs. Doctors are suggesting that she has 1 to 2 months to live, although we know that they are often wrong, and no one can ever predict how long someone will remain in the body. Lane was listed in the 90s as one of the world's best drummers. Her work has always focused on the spiritual and healing aspects of drumming and rhythm, and her unusual path has focused on the handheld frame drum, the world's oldest known drum. For 15 years, she researched the history of this drum and religious and healing rites in the ancient Mediterranean world, culminating in her wonderful 1997 book titled When the Drummers Were Women. The book details a lost history of a time when women were the primary percussionists in the ancient world and also explains why they are not today. We are told that she is improving a bit, determined to finish her latest film and get her affairs in order. We shall make prayers of honoring for this great spirit who has blessed our goddess community for many years with her rhythm and her wisdom. Thank you, Lane, for everything. Our prayers, good thoughts are with you. We honor you. And in honor of Lane, I'll be playing a piece of her music probably midway between guests tonight. But turning our attention to tonight's show, our first guest is Carol Brody Fleet, author of the book Widows Wear Stilettos. We'll be chatting about her book on widowhood called Happily Even After. I think this is so important as so many of our community is entering that time in their lives when this is something they might have to deal with when a partner, a loved one, or a parent even maybe passes away. In the second half of the show, I digress quite a bit from our mission statement with Betsy Lewis in her book, Angels, Aliens, and Prophecy, The Connection. Betsy Lewis. She's an intuitive earth mysteries investigator. She's going to explain her insights on how a mass UFO sighting, such as the well-documented one over Phoenix in 1997, is connected to apparitions like Our Lady of Fatima in Portugal in 1917. We'll get into what happened during her regression session, recalling her and her mother's abduction. She will tell us her thoughts on if the people in Japan were warned about the impending tsunami by ETs. We'll also talk about things, if we have time, like alien time jumpers. Sounds right off the Sci-Fi Channel, doesn't it? Well, I thought this might be a lot of fun. And if you've tuned in recently, you heard me talking to the Reverend Lorianne Vigny of the Fellowship of Isis and discussing her book, The 42 Ideals of the Goddess Ma'at. And silly me, I didn't get around to reading them all, so I thought over the next few weeks I'd read them to you. So tonight I will read the next 10. They are number 21, I Spread Joy, I Do the Best I Can, I Communicate with Compassion, I Listen to Opposing Opinions, I Create Harmony, I Invoke Laughter, I Am Open to Love in Various Forms, I Am Forgiving, I Am Kind, I Am Respectful of Others. That was number 30. Well, next week I will read the balance of the 42 Ideals of Ma'at, the Egyptian Goddess of Truth and Justice. Well, I think you're going to recognize this sound. Yep. Those are the bees buzzing around in my bonnet tonight. I just have to get this off my chest or my hair will certainly light a fire. My thoughts are on it's Paula Deen and racism. I'm going to just say this once and try to say it softly. Paula Deen is losing everything, apparently because of perceived racism. A woman who grew up in the South without the benefit of learning about racial discrimination said something awful. Yes, awful. I know from where she comes. I grew up in the Deep South. I definitely know racism. And she is losing everything for her honesty. I think what's happening to her is a gross exaggeration. Her punishment is not fitting the crime. That is one of my points. But what really has me going a little bonkers, what has me really perturbed, is the fact Paula Deen is being raked over the coals, but Republicans have racism in their platforms. They have given a pass. They are given a pass for their racism, their sexism, their homophobia, their anti-immigrant mentalities. Every day they disenfranchise black and brown-skinned people, especially with their jerry-rigged voting districts where more liberals and Democrats can come out and cast their vote, but their candidate will still lose to a Republican because of their gerrymandering, their cheating. Yes, cheating in voting districts to give them an advantage. Where's their concern for democracy? That's why they always want to go to war, isn't it? To spread democracy, they say. Well, why don't they treat it so sacredly at home? Why is it okay for a political party to practice blatant racism couched in words like they spin so well, calling it voter fraud when we know statistics show there is none, closing down polls in Democratic districts, not allowing voting on Sundays, needing voter ID cards when they know this will disproportionately affect Democratic voters. And what are they doing, women across the country? They want to go to war to make money, and they don't give a rat's patootie about democracy. And, what about their sexist war on women? They are denying them their constitutional rights to an abortion, thwarting their access to birth control. And state after state, they are putting into law state-sanctioned rape with their required vaginal probes, even doctors say are not necessary. Yes, my hair is on fire as I see how easy it is to rake a woman over the coals while a political party's racism is not given equal scrutiny, nor are they equally shamed. Well, that will have to conclude the bees buzzing round in my bonnet tonight. Feel free to email me. Okay, turning my attention to tonight's first guest, I am so glad to have with us Carol Brody Fleet. Let me tell you a bit about her and her great books, Happily Even After and Widows Wear Stilettos. She is the founder and chief CEO of Widows Wear Stilettos, Inc., widely recognized as a leader and expert in the areas of grief and loss recovery. Carol is a regular guest on national and international TV and radio shows. She's been featured in many magazines, newspapers, and websites, and is the recipient of the Embrace Life Award from State Farm Insurance Companies and the Board of Directors Outstanding Service Award from the Soaring Spirits Loss Foundation. She resides with her family in Southern California. And you can visit her website, Widows Wear Stilettos. She's also on Facebook and Twitter. So, Carol, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Thank you. Well, you know, let's start out with a question from one of my listeners. I think this might be a little bit different than what you might be accustomed to, but so many of my listeners will be aware that one of the Egyptian goddesses, Isis, who we talk about here as an archetype and as a deity sometimes, well, she's probably one of the most famous widows in history. I wonder if she informs your teaching at all, if she was a role model or archetype for you when you started to go about writing about, you know, how to survive being a widow.
Well, I'll be very honest, Karen. My personal healing it absolutely involves spirituality. I come from a faith-based place, and that's just Carol personally. But as an expert and as an author who needs to serve as many people as humanly possible, I intentionally chose not to write from or teach from a spiritually-based place, any kind of spirituality, including my own. And the reason is that we have to acknowledge that not everyone in the widowed community are believers in any deity or higher power. And then there are many more who are believers, but they are in a crisis of faith. They're angry at their higher power. They're angry at their god or goddess because of this horrible fate that's befallen them. So in order to serve as many as possible that have been touched by the pain and the challenge that widowhood presents, I chose and continue to choose to teach from a secular place.
Okay, fair enough. And that makes a lot of sense. It really does, because I can certainly imagine, you know, when we have these horrible challenges, death, sickness, divorce sometimes, you know, we often think, why me? You know, why has,
sure,
you know, why has our God forsaken me? What did I do to deserve this? And
I spent 2 years asking that question. I spent 2 years very angry asking that question.
So then you were inspired to write this book because you found yourself a widow?
Actually, I wasn't inspired to write the first book until many years later, after both myself and my daughter Kendall had made what I felt were good recoveries in our healing journey. And what I started doing one evening was just writing down all the things that I'd been looking for as a widow and could not find. Too many of the books that I had found, and they were wonderful books, but too many of them, to me, just focused on grief and only grief. And I do believe, and I teach, that you gravitate toward what you focus on. I think that it's an absolute guarantee that if you focus on grief, you're going to be kept in a place of grief and sorrow. And for me, that wasn't an option. It's wonderful and fine and to grieve, and we need to, but how do we get our benefits from the government? And how do I help my child when I can't even help myself? And how do I deal with the opinions that are surrounding me that aren't necessarily positive or supportive? And what about questions like, you know, dating again, falling in love again, things like that and so much more nobody was talking about? And I thought that maybe I could start a dialogue and I could help one or two people. And I had no idea at the time where that journey was going to take me. But, of course, some of the most wonderful journeys in the world happen by accident.
Absolutely.
And that's what's happened with us.
Well, I think I read that some of your book, or maybe a lot of your book, is based on letters you got from people who found out about your work. What was the most common problem, you know, do you find either you had or most of your fans or followers seem to have?
The most common problem, I think, is guilt. And there are so many, that's a whole other show, there are so many complexions and facets to guilt. That is a huge issue, but we get thousands of letters every month, and we have for years. And so many of those letters start out with, is it okay if I? Or when is it appropriate to? And when somebody starts out a letter like that, what they are really saying is, I want to do this, and at least one person has put doubt into my head, and I need someone to tell me it's okay. It's okay to take my rings off. It's okay to leave my rings on. It's okay to sell my house. It's okay to stay in my house. It's okay to remarry. It's okay to choose. Choose is an important word. Choose to remain content on my own. And that is the most common thing that I see, is what I call the permission factor. And the wonderful thing about the book, Happily Even After, is without exception, every single question in that book comes from an actual letter written by a real widowed person. So a reader can pick up this book and see, oh my gosh, she went through problems with her in-laws, or oh, he went through issues with his adult children. They can see that they're not alone in their challenges and their situations when they pick up this book, because at least one other person out there is dealing with the same thing. And that's our first avenue of comfort.
So then, just to clarify, what we're saying tonight goes for men and women, widows and widowers.
Absolutely. We're proud to serve anybody and everybody who has lost the person they expected to spend the rest of their life with, and that is with no regard to age or gender or sexual orientation, technical marital status, if you lost your fiancé, your boyfriend, your girlfriend. We don't care how long you've been widowed. A lot of support groups will actually kick you out after you've been widowed for a certain amount of time. It doesn't matter how you lost your beloved. We are not specific to one certain methodology of death. If you lost the person that you committed the rest of your life to, we're here to help.
And would some of these tips that you're going to give or advice, there's all different sorts of loss, you know, whether it be a breakup or distance or a divorce. Do you think that some of the things you're going to say may also apply to these other types of happenings that may cause us grief or permanent or temporary distance, to a certain extent?
Absolutely. I speak to all kinds of loss. I've spoken to the widow community because that's the community that I come from. But I have absolutely spoken to people who've been through divorce, whether they were left behind or did the leaving, that have been through breakup, that have been victims of domestic violence, that have lost homes, that have suffered financial challenge. Loss is loss. Now, we can't compare one loss to another because all loss perspectives are different. For example, I lost my husband, and 4 months later, I lost my father. Now, those are two gargantuan losses, but because your relationship to the person lost is different, the loss perspective is different. So the grief process differs somewhat. But loss is loss, and grief needs to be nursed and nurtured and acknowledged, not hidden away. We don't need to be told to get over it. Why aren't you over it? We need support, and we need community, and we need healing tools to help us continue forward on our journey.
So now maybe this is as varied as there are people out there, but it seemed like you were talking about early on giving ourselves permission to do things, which seems to imply to me that there are some either culturally imposed, ideas imposed by religion or particular family values that sort of put us in a box. Did you find that there was anything in particular that seemed to be the number one stumbling block that hinders healing from loss?
The most prevalent stumbling block that I have found, and it hurts my heart, is that people are not finding their voice, finding their center, and operating from that center, in that you are in charge of your healing journey. I can't be in charge of it. That means I don't have a right to an opinion. Unless you are dealing destructively, that means any kind of abuse or compulsive behavior. And there's help for that too. But short of that, whatever you decide to do on your healing journey is really okay. And then you have one person come along and say, well, Karen, you know, it's only been a year. How can you think about dating again? Or, Karen, it's been a year. Why aren't you dating again?
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, you can hear 99 positive things. It only takes one negative to undo it all. And one of my jobs is to convey to the widow community in particular, nobody is driving home from work at night thinking, I wonder if that Karen Tate is out on a date right now. What is she thinking?
Right.
What is she doing? What a nerve. You know, nobody's doing that. We are not nearly as important to other people's lives as we'd like to think we are. But the problem is that people are coming out with negative opinions, non-supportive opinions, and the widowed, male and female, gay and straight, get it into their head that, okay, I've caught my limit. I'm done with love now. And that hurts my heart at any age. But when you hear that from somebody who is in their late teens or their 20s, you know, you get a little angry about it. You have bees in your bonnet earlier. And by the way, kudos to you, girlfriend. that puts bees in my bonnet. And so my job is to help the widowed find their voice and then use it and have the attitude that this is my journey and I am in the driver's seat of the car that is my healing journey.
Well, you know, we talk a lot about women's empowerment here, and
mm-hmm.
we're always encouraging women to find their, you know, to stand in their own power, to find their voice. You know, sometimes
right.
we call it their sacred roar. And I would
mm-hmm.
imagine that this is really hard for a woman who maybe, you know, has been in a family that has sort of dominated her or a husband that's dominated her, even if her husband is maybe the one who she loves and passed away. If she's not accustomed to standing up for herself and giving herself permission, I bet it's even harder for maybe that type woman to throw off those shackles of other people's opinions or, I don't know, call it cultural or, you know, religious or societal mores, I guess.
Right. And what we find is that the younger the woman, the more prevalent that is. When somebody is widowed anywhere from their late teens to their late 20s, you will see parents of the widowed or in-laws just swoop in and start appropriating things or taking over funeral plans and really relegating the widow to childhood.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is somebody who got married or was living a committed life with somebody, but all of a sudden now they're gone and she doesn't have a say. That's why what we do is so important. Because, again, like I said, regardless of age or gender or sexual orientation, this is about your healing journey and it's helping you find your voice and helping you use that voice, and then helping you heal in the most positive and productive and proactive ways possible.
Are there, you mentioned support groups out there,
mm-hmm.
aside from your book. Where does one find healthy support groups?
Well, you can start right at widowswearstilettos.com. We have a peer-led in-person support group throughout the United States and Canada. There is absolutely no charge to attend. There are no dues. It is free of charge, and it is led by your peers. It's led by your community. And all of that information is on our website. And also, you know, online has become a wonderful source of support. There are other organizations aside from Widows Wear Stilettos who do offer wonderful online support. Our online group at Facebook, we're at Widows Wear Stilettos on Facebook, is a wonderful source of community and friendship and also hot topic discussions. You know, if you have an issue, let's talk about it. there really is no subject that's off limits with widows wear stilettos, because so many people are already afraid of talking about certain components of their widowhood.
Right. I love that title,
away.
By the way. How did you come by that title? Were you feeling sexy one day and went out and bought a pair?
Actually, you know what, Karen? It couldn't be more opposite from that. I've always been a high heel shoe girl. But that title actually came from one of my few lucid moments at my late husband's funeral. And that was the first time that the word widow ever entered my head. Because when you're dealing with an illness for 2 years, you're not thinking about widowhood, you're thinking about survival. And when it dawned on me, oh my gosh, I'm the widowed, they're going to give an American flag to me because I'm the widow, the very next thought that came into my head was, I can't be a widow, I wear 5-inch heels. And I drink martinis. And because we all have the stereotyped image of who and what a widow looks like.
Right.
And that was where I was at that moment in time. 5 years later, when I started writing, Widows Wear Stilettos became my way of saying, we're here too. We count.
Yeah.
We matter. We are not going to be content in the shadows anymore. We are not going to be ignored because the subject of death is uncomfortable. We matter. And so it was kind of my way of finding my voice and using it. But I didn't realize that it also became a dress requirement. Now I'm not allowed to wear anything but stilettos.
So you said that your husband was ill for 2 years, which makes me wonder. And God, I'm going to give myself permission to ask this question.
Absolutely.
If someone has a terminally ill family member, husband, wife, mm-hmm. whatever, should they, on some level, on some small way, should they be preparing themselves? Is that anything you address in the book?
I don't address that in the book because I concentrate, well, and happily even after, because there were a couple of questions about women who were facing widowhood. They knew it was in their future, just as I was. But by and large, in both books, I address what happens now and what happens next, now that your loved one has passed away. When there's a terminal illness, sometimes our focus tends to be on losing them. We have to remember, don't go to the funeral while the person is still sitting in front of you. Because when you aren't in that moment, which is so vital, you're missing out on the precious time that you have left. And like you said earlier, doctors can guess, they can, they can project, they can, but it's not a finite science when it comes to figuring out a prognosis for somebody.
Right,
so
right.
let's focus on the here and now. That said, always create an environment where the patient knows that if they need to talk about what's going on, whether it is fear, sadness, anger, which makes people uncomfortable, create that atmosphere where they know that it's always going to be okay to talk about it.
Yeah. Well,
but
just, I'm a pragmatic Virgo. So I guess, though, I'm thinking to myself, if you're, let's just say, a woman who doesn't know how to balance the checkbook, who doesn't know how to work the DVR, who maybe doesn't know where the will is or how your finances are, what the portfolio looks like.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as callous as it might sound, it would seem like to me getting some of those answers before it's too late might be something you do have to think about.
I in fact, that is a vital part of my teaching, is that, okay, you're widowed. Some of you may have gone through that very scenario you just described. Here's the deal, folks. It's the 21st century. There is no excuse any longer to say he handled all the finances or she balanced the checkbook, because, it's not just the women who are sometimes left without a clue. Sometimes
it's
the guys, too, because they just walk in and hand the check to the missus and they go on about their business.
Yeah,
there's
he took
no
care of the yard.
Right. There's no excuse for that. In this day and age, you must be prepared. You must have a will. You must have a small life insurance policy. If you're a member of the LGBT community, even though we've had some wonderful things happen in the last week, things, you know, the dust is still kind of settling. You must decide who's going to advocate for you until we figure out where and how all this is going to settle down. You must absolutely protect yourself and the people you are going to leave behind, because we're all going to do it someday, okay?
Yeah, because
that,
you know, we live in a...
So being a pragmatic Virgo is a great thing.
Well, and you know, and also, too, you know, we live in a culture that is so fearful of death. You know, I mean, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I don't say that lightly. I mean, even, you know, people within goddess spirituality who on a, you know, on a logical level understand that goddesses, you know, the goddess from womb to tomb, she is about the cycles of life, you know, you still have to face that, you know, that day is going to come. But I guess I wonder if that's anything that have come up in the letters, you know, just this people's denial that it was really going to happen. Is that a problem sometimes?
Denial can be a way of the body cushioning itself. The body, the human body is a magnificent thing. And when everybody complains, for example, about the fog of widowhood, that's nothing to complain about. That is your body cushioning you against the shock of what you've sustained. You know, this horrible loss that you've sustained. So the body's cushioning you. Instead of fighting that fog, let the fog envelop you. Let this phase envelop you and kind of cushion you, because the fog will lift. And it's okay to let that fog happen. To remain in denial, however, to not, you know, continue to move forward in the direction that a journey is going to take you, that's not okay. But
now,
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I was going to say, you know, you also talk about, you know, you think it's important to treasure and honor a past life, but without
mm-hmm.
actually living in the past.
Absolutely.
Speak to that a little bit?
I would be delighted to. That is my mantra, and it is something that I get a little preachy about, actually. Too many people think that by moving forward into a life of happiness and abundance and peace and promise, that they are disrespecting or dishonoring their past. They get it, or they're disrespecting the memory of their beloved. My life today is really incredible. In 2009, I married an absolutely beautiful man. He is incredible. He works side by side with me in the widowed community, and he's not a widower. He saw what I was doing, and he said, I can help you take this where it needs to go. And he's been working tirelessly ever since. He brought with him into our marriage a beautiful daughter who is finally the sister that I could never give to my daughter. And we have a wonderful family, and I get to live a life of service to others in need. Now, does any of that cast aspersion on the memory of my late husband and the life that we lived together as a family? Absolutely not. You can treasure your past. You can honor your past. You should certainly love your past. You don't have to live in your past. You just don't have to. And, you know, what legacies are our loved ones leaving to us when they leave this world? My late husband left the legacies of service and love. He was a police officer for 28 years in Santa Ana, California. That is not an easy tour to do. And before that, he served his country, two tours of duty in Vietnam. That's a legacy of service. And then a legacy of love, the love that he had for his family, for his friends, for his work. These are legacies that were left to carry on, and you can't do that if you are trying to live a life that is no longer here for you to live.
Okay. Well, and you also refer to the lighter side of widowhood. That almost, you know, what could the lighter side possibly be?
It sounds oxymoronic, doesn't it?
It does.
The lighter side are things like, well, certainly when I speak to dating, you know, we got to get a sense of humor about dating, because you know what? It's just funny, okay? And in fact, I teach a whole workshop on that, and we have a good time. The lighter side can also encompass things that, you know, can tend to hurt. One of the biggest issues that we do see are those things that people say. And I've seen relationships ruined because somebody said the wrong thing. Now, a lot of times people don't mean to say the wrong thing. Not always. Some people do have an alternative agenda, which is sad. But people will say the wrong thing. It was insensitive. It was inappropriate, what have you. So we take some of the things that people say, and we put a humorous spin on it, and then we teach what to say instead and what to do instead. You know, you don't try and tell a widow while you're at the funeral that she's young and pretty and will meet somebody else. You know, that's what I mean. You have to take some of what, nothing's funny about being widowed. Nothing's funny about widowhood. But some of the things that happen along the journey, it's funny. And when we turn things on their ear, we shift a paradigm, we laugh a little bit. Once you're laughing, and this is scientific, the brain relaxes. It opens up. And when that happens, you are now ready to receive positive information.
Okay.
So I will always get people laughing whenever I can.
Well, and you talk about some letters that you received that spouses that, you know, when their loved one died, it turned out they were having extramarital affairs and, you know, all sorts of hidden stuff. Wow, that can be just devastating to the one left behind.
It is a multi-layer devastation. Think of kind of like a seven-layer bean dip. You don't just have the base of that, which is widowhood. That is enough in and of itself. But now you have the betrayal, and inevitably, and women are more guilty of this than men, women will assume it's something they did or didn't do, and they're stupid, and they're embarrassed, and they're ashamed. So now you've got layers of grief and layers of betrayal. Then you've got the anger factor, and you begin to question your entire life with this person, and rightfully so. And that's not the only, you know, unpleasant surprise that crops up after death. Behind betrayal, extramarital betrayal, is financial betrayal. When you find out that your spouse had a second and third mortgage on the house or a $250,000 line of credit, I believe that was in the book, and you had no idea, and now you may be liable for it. So there's all kinds of things that can happen after death, and so what we need to teach there is understanding you can't confront the betrayal directly. You can't go to the person directly and say, what's up with this? So we have to learn how to deal with that aspect of grief in addition to the grief that every widow suffers.
Well, speaking of not being able to go back and say, what's up with this, I would imagine a lot of those letters must have been people who didn't get a chance to say the things that they maybe wish they had said.
And here comes our old friend guilt. Because what of the widowed who their last words were, why don't you ever pick your underwear up off the floor? Or you had a tremendous fight and somebody stormed out and that is how that's how things were left when somebody passed away. And what I do there is encourage somebody who had that set of circumstances. We all argue with our spouses. We do, and it's a fact of life. While my late husband was ill, we argued. We're human beings, and it's part of the normalcy of a healthy relationship. My husband today and I argue daily.
Well, and it might even be from feeling helpless and vulnerable too. You know,
bring up
those sorts of things.
But that's absolutely true. But in a situation like that, where your last words might not have been "I love you."
Right.
What we need to do is let's focus on the totality of the relationship, not on 10 minutes of why didn't you pick your underwear up off the floor. That's not what encapsulates a relationship. Let's focus on falling in love and being in love and building a life together, whatever your life looked like. Let's focus on that. Let's look at that. It's just like many people are not there when their loved one passes away, and they feel like they didn't get to say goodbye because they weren't there. And while they may not have been there at that particular moment in time, What was your life like together with that person? When did you say goodbye to them? My father passed away, but I was not there when he passed away, but I had spent time with him. He was in a coma, and I'd spent time with him the week before talking to him, and I'm absolutely convinced he could hear me because he was squeezing my hand. And for me, that brought me a huge amount of peace.
Right.
Because in my mind, I did get to say goodbye.
Right,
to him.
Right.
So it's about looking at a life in sum, not just in part.
Right, I understand. Don't let those last, you know, the lack maybe of those last minutes color everything else, you know.
Right.
Because that wouldn't be your life in the proper context.
Exactly.
Well, how should people help and comfort those who are widowed? What's your best advice?
My best advice is to always create the environment where you are ready to listen and you are ready to encourage. Don't tell somebody what to do. Don't tell someone, I know how you feel, because you don't. I hate those words. And be there, and you tell them constantly if you have to, when you're ready to talk, I'm here and I want to listen. Don't be afraid to bring up their loved ones. You know, you can use their name. You can say things like, how are you doing? And mean it, not, hey, how's it going? And if your opinion is not positive or supportive or helpful, say it to yourself silently first. And if it's not positive, let's not put it out into the universe, because that's
right.
Not going to help somebody.
Well, no, you don't like the word closure either.
I hate that word, along with size zero. Don't like those words either.
What's wrong with closure? You know, we think of the word closure as something that gives us solace or sort of makes things better.
Closure in today's lexicon has become a fast and kicky way of saying you're over it. When a widowed person, or any person, I believe, that has suffered a tremendous loss, here's the word, now you'll have closure. What the bereaved is hearing is, okay, it's closed. It's done. Dust off your hands. Go on to the next thing. I'm not allowed to talk about it. I'm not allowed to feel about it. I'm not allowed to think about it. It's closed. Because
it's
that's
like
the root word.
It's too final, you mean.
When
these things maybe don't have a definitive end.
That's right. Because the healing journey never ends. And the sooner we embrace that, the happier and more peaceful we will all be. It never ends. Closure is not helpful. It's not. Closure is something that surgeons do at the end of an operation. Closure is something that happens to the freeway during rush hour. Closure is not something that you can do to your heart. Okay,
but
we lose people.
But what do you say to the person, Carol, who says, "I want this pain to end"? You know. I don't want to feel this pain anymore.
Nobody wants to. Nobody likes pain. Nobody wants to feel that. And the bad news here, the unfortunate part is you have to go through it. You cannot try and circumvent it. If you try and circumvent it, it will come back to bite you. The absolute arch enemies to pain and grief and feeling lost are proactivity. Get proactive about your healing journey. First of all, what kind of healing tools have you gathered? Books, audio, visual, the internet, support groups, mental health counseling, whatever it is that speaks to you that's going to propel you in a forward-thinking and forward-moving motion on your healing journey. Proactivity cannot exist in the same place as pain. It doesn't mean that pain doesn't happen. It doesn't mean that tears don't come. But when you are proactive, when you make the conscious choice, today I'm going to do something to enable my healing journey to move forward. And when you do that and it becomes a part of you, remarkable things happen. What is difficult is when someone will tell me I'm in so much pain and it hurts and I don't know what to do, and I'll say, well, have you gotten any books? Have you gotten any CDs? Have you done that? And the answer is no. They are just sitting around waiting to feel better. That's why I also hate the phrase, time heals all wounds. if you just sit around waiting to feel better, the only thing you're going to accomplish, Karen, is a whole bunch of waiting.
Yeah.
You've got to be proactive. And again, it's about taking control over a situation where you've had little or no control at all. We cannot control life or death, but we can darn sure control how we react to it and how we move forward from it.
So say you're a person who, you know, what if you're, say, let's just say a woman or a man whose spouse dies and you don't really have any children or family to speak of, and one of the hardest things is just being alone. You know, books and audio tapes and all of that, I mean, they only go so far, I would think. It feels like that's a very solitary way to be proactive. What are some other ways for somebody who is feeling just the loneliness is devastating?
It is, and there's no doubt about that. Again, your proactivity should take place in the form of getting around other people. Other people can be incredibly helpful. Start out with a support group. If you have trouble locating a support group, you can start with a house of worship, hospital, hospice. Again, the internet is a great resource. You plug in what kind of support group you're looking for, and chances are excellent you're going to find something very close to where you are. So it's surrounding yourself with other people. I also believe and teach that when we're in service to others, we automatically feel better. This is, you know, my way of being in service is to serve the widowed and the bereaved communities. When you get outside of your own paradigm, you can't help but feel better. My uncle, who we all love very much, passed away a couple of years ago. And my aunt, who, you know, my cousins are grown, we're all adults now, my aunt volunteered at a senior center. So just so she could be around other people and do for somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
Then these are all very positive things. Another thing, and again, women sometimes have a hard time doing this, what's your passion? What do you love to do? Do you love to create pottery or paint or dance or play tennis? Or you know, what do you love that maybe you've had to put to one side because you had to raise kids or take care of an ill loved one? What do you love? Because you know what? You can go back to that. You can go strap on the tap shoes or go run a marathon, or we just got done with a triathlon in Southern California. You can do these things.
Right, right.
There's so many ways.
If you can get past the idea that, you know, if you don't let the guilt set in that, you know, these are sort of liberating things, then that could be maybe a lighter side of widowhood.
Absolutely. It is. It, you know, the first time my daughter wanted to go to a movie, I think it was about a month or two after her dad died, and we went to the movie, and it was a comedy, and we laughed. And I laughed, and I went, what am I doing laughing? My husband's passed away. And then I thought, if I don't laugh, if I stay sad, he's still not here. And that's when I gave myself permission to start laughing again. Something that simple.
Right, incredibly
freeing.
So if you were to give some first steps to beginning the healing journey, maybe you've already given some with the CDs and the audio tapes and the volunteering, or are there other things that you want to make sure listeners know about?
Absolutely. The first thing you need to do is make the choice. Now, I know that might sound simple, maybe even a little stupid. Make the choice that you're going to heal. Make it a conscious choice. Today is the beginning of my healing journey. Everything I've done up to today, you know, if it hasn't been helping me, it's not a part of the equation now. I am choosing to feel better, and I'm going to do what I need to do to get myself there. And I'm going to get myself the help and the support and the direction that I need. Take control of your journey. That is the most important piece of advice I can give. It's the most important takeaway. Make the choice to start feeling better. Everybody in the world can be divided into one of two columns, energy givers and energy drainers. You've got to get yourself around energy givers. They are the people that are going to help you on your healing journey. You are going to limit or eliminate altogether negativity, negative opinions, negative viewpoint, anything that is not going to be part of your solution. You've got to make those choices too. Look at who your circle of influence is.
Yeah, I mean, it's like we talk about, you know, removing, cut away the toxic people in your life. Even, I mean, people may be well-meaning, but if they're keeping you depressed, you know, keeping you in a state of guilt, keeping you living
right.
in the past, then mm-hmm. even though they may be well-intentioned, that you know, you aren't, maybe they're holding back your healing.
That's right, because energy drainers, they don't necessarily want to hurt you. But they don't want to help you either. They want you to be unhappy because they've chosen to be unhappy. They don't want you to succeed because they've chosen to not be successful. They are putting their decisions on you. Now, why would you let someone else decide your destiny? You've already been handed an apparent destiny that you didn't choose. That's why I was so proactive on my healing journey. If I didn't choose it, I don't want it. I did not choose widowhood as a destiny. And I'm not going to be defined by loss and pain and grief. So that's where all, you know, the choice comes in. And energy drainers are not going to help you, and they're not going to be productive.
Well, I mean, obviously everyone is different, and, you know, this shouldn't be taken as the norm. But
right.
how long was it before you started feeling good again?
Feeling good again. That's a relative term. Well, you have to remember too, I lost my husband. 3 weeks later, I collapsed and I underwent emergency abdominal surgery. That was number 10 of what has been 13 abdominal surgeries. And then it was immediately after that that my father was diagnosed with terminal cancer.
Wow.
So the first 6 months are kind of a blur. I have to think that when I really started feeling kind of like Carol again, was shortly after my father passed away, a couple of months after that, my daughter and I took a vacation, and it was the first non-business travel I had done since Mike had become ill. And we were just girls in Las Vegas eating ice cream and looking at the flamingos at the Flamingo Hilton and shopping, and it was a feeling of lightness.
Mm-hmm.
I felt just very light and unburdened because I felt like I was finally beginning to make an entree back into a life that I could love again.
Wow. So you're talking about, almost a year, it seems like, you know.
Right.
It
was 9 months. It was, in fact, we actually took our vacation. It was 2 weeks prior to 9/11 happening.
Wow.
Was when we took that, it was 9 months.
Do you find that people who maybe have been married for decades, it's more difficult for them than maybe people who have been married shorter periods of time, or does it really just vary?
It doesn't. Well, first of all, we don't ever want to say more difficult, less difficult. It's different. The issues are different depending on chronological age and length of time married. Loss, spousal loss is spousal loss. And you've got people who are married for decades who are really on now a journey of self-discovery. Who am I without this person I was married to for over 50 years? Versus chronologically younger widowed who were maybe left pregnant. They never got the chance to have children. They have younger adolescent children. My daughter was 11 when her dad passed away. And those are entirely different issues.
Right.
And here again, let's bring in those energy drainers for a minute. With people who weren't married for very long, what you hear is, well, you know, you weren't married that long, so it's not going to be that hard for you. So we've just trivialized the marriage. And then you have people who are married for decades, like my aunt and uncle. And my aunt was being told, well, you had 53 years together and you had a full life together. You know, Karen, I've never had one person in my life ever come up to me and say, well, we were married for 30, 40 years and that was enough. I'm good. You
yeah.
know, nobody has ever done that and they never will. So
it's just
a question of different. It's not more difficult, less difficult. It's different issues.
Right,
and we address
right.
those issues at both ends of the spectrum.
Now, your workshops that you mentioned, are these online or in person where
these
you
live?
These
are in person. These are in-person appearances that I do. And the organization will let me know what kind of workshop they want. And two of the most popular, as you might guess, are the world of dating and the intricacies of intimacy. because that's another huge issue in the widow community, is becoming intimate with somebody who isn't the person that you were married to before, and all of those emotions, and the physicalities, and those are two very popular workshops that
I would
that
imagine.
I teach.
I would imagine. So now tell us your website again if someone wants to know more about the books or the workshops, Carol.
The website is widowswearstilettos.com. Stilettos has one L and two T's. And we're also on Facebook at Widows Wear Stilettos. You can find us there. And all the information about everything in the world is at those two places. Both books, Widows Wear Stilettos and Happily Even After, are in wide release, and they're carried at all stores, in-person stores, Target, Walmart, and so forth, chain bookstores, independents, and they're also available at all major online bookstores as well.
Okay. Well, Carol, it has been a pleasure to talk to you tonight. I can see why this work is so important, obviously, and you have such a sense of humor and such empathy. You're just wonderful. You really are. Thank you so much for coming on tonight, and I'm sure this was very helpful to some of my listeners out there.
Well, I hope so, and thank you, Karen. It's been my pleasure, and thank you for letting me spend time with you tonight.
Okay, good night, and the best to you.
And to you.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, I see my second guest is on the switchboard, and I will be getting to Betsy in just a couple moments here as soon as we take care of a little bit of business.
The psychic state is the collective unconscious, which is that consciousness of the planet. It's called the chthonic mind, the mind of the earth.
Our ancestors understood that the animal and the divine were all connected. They were together. That there wasn't a separation. And that's what we are trying to return to, is that sense that our animal nature is divine. It doesn't get in the way of the divine. It gets us closer to it.
What's your idea of being fully alive as a human being? Because that's what's really spiritual. Write it down. Start writing your own Bible if you want.
Sex is sacred. And by that, I just mean sweaty, fun, happy sex.
Well, those were some of the words of Jo Carson and the folks on her wonderful DVD, Dancing with Gaia. It's a feature documentary about earth energy, sacred sexuality, and the return of goddesses Gaia. It's a sincere and beautiful, beautiful film that goes deep into the connections between these important topics of sacred sexuality and earth energy and discovering the goddess within and the goddess in nature, the external, the internal. The DVD comes packaged with a 45-page mini book that expands on the material in the film, and you can find out more about it at dancingwithgaia.com. I have seen the film, and I do highly recommend it. I think you'll be happy with it. It's something that you'd probably want to keep in your library. Well, that sound is probably familiar to my regular listeners, that those chimes mean we are crossing the threshold into the second half of the show. And as I promised at the opening, I wanted to just play a cut of music to honor our beloved Lane Redman, who is very ill. So what I'd like to do for the next couple minutes here is just play one of her cuts called Invoking Aphrodite, and then when I come back we will start that our sci-fi interview with Betsy Lewis on angels, aliens, and prophecy and what that connection is between them all. But first, here's Invoking Aphrodite with Lane Redman. And I'm not sure, this might start about 10 seconds in, so if you hear silence for a little bit, don't panic. Mm-hmm.
come here. Come to the holy place. Come to the sacred grove. Your altars are smoking with incense. Cold water sings through the fruited trees. Everything is shaded under the bower of roses. And from the shimmering radiance of leaves, an enchanted sleep drops down. Here is a meadow of spring flowers where horses graze, and a soft wind gently breathes. Come, Aphrodite, pour your nectar into our golden cup. In grace, make the libation. Bring your Melissa to life.
Beloved Lane Redman, author of When the Drummers Were Women, and our prayers go out to her. Please keep her in your thoughts. Keep her name on your altar. May she be embraced in the wings of the goddess. Well, as I said, we're crossing the threshold into the second part of the show, and I wonder, do you know about the Goddess Spirit Rising Conference in Malibu in September? Well, never before in the United States has a goddess conference brought together so many internationally renowned goddess scholars, authors, deep thinkers, ceremonialists, artists, musicians, and others who love and live the sacred feminine. The Goddess Spirit Rising Conference, September 6th, 7th, and 8th, is 3 days of over 40 workshops, ceremonies, and offerings celebrating She Who Is All in a glorious setting right on the beach in Malibu, California. Complete with their very own conference temple, vending hall, comfy lodging, and meals, on Saturday night, the group will gather for a brilliant concert featuring Jennifer Berezin, Anique Radianheart, Ruth Barrett, Judy Piazza. People are coming in from all across the globe. Kathy Jones from England, Anique from Australia, Sandra Roamane from Spain, Isadora Liedenfrost from the Red Tent Movement will be there, Joan Marler, Vicki Noble, Z Budapest. It's an unbelievable lineup. And right now you can still get the early bird price for $350 if you register now. Prices will go up very soon. For more information, you can go to the website goddessspiritrising.com to register and claim your place for this historical event, or to just get more information about the day-to-day activities. You don't have to go for the entire weekend. You can just get a day pass. Okay, first up, here we have Betsy Lewis. Hi, Betsy.
Hi, Karen. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you so much for being on the show tonight.
Well, thank you, and I hope everybody's sitting back and having a glass of wine.
Well, I hope
Excuse me, too.
I promised at the top of the hour the show was going to turn into the Sci-Fi Channel in the second half of the show.
Maybe.
Well, let me tell listeners a little bit about you, Betsy, and then we're going to jump in here and talk
about all
of these interesting topics. So listeners, Betsy Lewis, she is an intuitive, she's an Earth Mysteries investigator. I love that title. That's awesome. She's the host on Blog Talk 2 of a popular show with the Rainbow Vision Network since 2009. She's been investigating UFO sightings and mysterious cattle mutilations for over 40 years. She inherited the gift of prophecy from her mother, giving her the ability to foresee the future. Then two major UFO events transformed her early life at the age of 8 months when she and her parents had a terrifying UFO encounter on a deserted road in Idaho, and again at the age of 7 when Betsy was chased by a massive silver disc while walking home from first grade. Shortly after her second encounter, she experienced dreams of cataclysmic earth changes, which are now taking place worldwide. Betsy's been interviewed on TV, radio shows, keynote speaker at UFO conferences, in Alamo, Nevada, in your area 51. She lives in Boise, Idaho with her husband. Her website is her name, Betsy with an EY, BetsyLewis.com. So Betsy, you have been gifted, challenged. I'm not sure what to call it, with some things happening to you that most of us maybe don't ever have happen. Was that traumatic for you to deal with as a child?
Well, there was a lot of things going on in my life as a child, and you know, it became very normal for me. And I had a mother who was totally into everything like that. She was into the paranormal. She remembered past lives. She believed in extraterrestrials. And she was just a major inspiration for me. We would also do psychic different experiments, telepathy and telekinesis. So she was she was wonderful. And, you know, I don't think most parents out there, you know, most people don't have parents like that. So I think I was really lucky.
I think you were too, because in how many families stuff like that would be considered of the devil, or they would tell you it was foolishness and you would be ridiculed, you know, as opposed to maybe developing your intuitive gifts.
Oh, absolutely. She was wonderful. And,
so let me ask you, the show is supposed to be about the connection between all of this, the angels, the aliens, the prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you were, you know, there. What do you call it? Your first event was when you were only 8 months. You probably can't remember that, but then again, when you were 7.
Right.
Why you? You know, why do you have any a sense of why you?
No.
Was it because of your intuitive ability?
You know, I don't know. They say there's been a poll taken, and they say that there's close to 8 million people in the United States alone that believe that they've had some kind of extraterrestrial encounter, either abducted or just some encounter. And so there's many, many people out there. And I ask myself that too, you know, why? Why me? Why my family? Why? And I'm sure many people like Travis Walton, who's a very famous case, he's probably asked that same question, why me?
Well, you know, since you can't really remember, and your mother was, obviously an adult when your first time was at 8 months. I mean, did she have one of those typical situations where you hear on TV, you know, with the, you know, with the probes or the maybe artificially inseminated or experimented on? Was it anything like that? I mean, did she tell you?
Well, the thing was that my parents told me that they were traveling on this road. I was only 8 months old. They were attending the University of Moscow, Idaho, which is up in the panhandle of Idaho. and they were going to southern Idaho to visit my family, my grandparents, and they were in an area called New Meadows, which is just kind of a, you know, barren area. There was a few ranches out there at the time, and they hadn't seen a car for miles, and out of the clear blue, they hear this roar, this horrendous roar that vibrated the car. It was just so intense. It just came right on them. And, of course, they were scared to death. They thought a plane was going to crash on them. So my father remembers, you know, pulling over to the side of the road. They jumped out. They looked around. The noise, the roar stopped. There was nothing, nothing in the sky to explain what had just happened. And the strange thing was that, you know, that was the story they always told. But in 1981, 82, my uncle came to me and he said, well, did they tell you the story about their encounter? And I said, well, they told me that there was a roar, but that's all they remembered. He said, well, did they tell you that they couldn't account for 2 hours? And I said, no. Are you serious? He says, of course. I remember, you know, we thought your parents were in a car accident, because my father always knew what time he would arrive in Twin Falls, and they were 2 hours late.
So they had that typical lost time scenario that you hear about so much.
Exactly.
So did your uncle, you know, spill the beans about what happened during those 2 hours, or did your parents not know?
They didn't remember anything. That was the strange part. They just didn't remember anything, and there was nothing in the sky to explain what had happened.
Now,
so
you, though, Betsy, are you surprised that this hasn't happened to you again since you were, you know, just a young child?
Well, I've had a lot of really strange experiences. I've seen a lot of things in the sky. I've had some things that I just can't explain. I don't know if it was ETs. I don't know if it was a ghost. But I've had a lot of paranormal experiences through my life. And it was after my second experience when I was 7 years old and walking along the street that I saw a silver disc and it started chasing me. And of course, you know,
being a silver disc,
it was just huge. It was a gray, it was a silver gray disc. And what was strange about it, it would increase and decrease in size. And it was following me. And I would hide in the bushes.
Was this like down a normal street, or were you in some rural area? Out in the middle of nowhere?
No, that's a strange thing. It was in Twin Falls, Idaho. It was a gray day. It was a cloudy day. I remember that. And I don't know, it was a busy, usually a really busy street. It only took me maybe 10, 15 minutes to walk home from school. And that day, I don't know, there was just this weird something in the sky that kept following me. And you know, when you know something's watching you, you get that strange feeling, you know, like the hair just stands up on your arms and your body. And I felt that there was something there. And, you know, and when I saw this, I ran, and then I hid. And then I remember trying to pound on a door. I went in a completely different direction than I usually went to go home. At least that's what I think it was, not unless it was a screen memory. And I pounded on the door. No one answered. The door was unlocked. And I went inside, and I hid under the bed. Now, I don't know how long I was there, but, of course, when I finally got home, my mother was frantic. She said that I had been gone for an hour, and I, you know, I just don't know. But
so you think you lost time, too, or you were just hiding under the bed that long?
No, you know, I don't know. That's the strange part. I don't really know. But that's when the dream started.
So tell us about that.
Well, I started having these recurring dreams over and over of major earth changes. I was not a child in these dreams. I was, like, much older. I was with a group of people either escaping volcanic eruptions. There was earthquakes. There were winds, just fierce winds. I could see huge waves, like tsunami waves, coming in. And I thought, this is crazy. You know, I'd wake up and, you know, I thought, why am I having these dreams? And they were always the same, over and over and over. And it was during this time that I felt that a message had been given to me, but erased from my memory. And over I said, I know I'll remember this when I get older someday. And I feel that this message that was given to me, I know what that is. And it has to do with these earth changes and what's going on.
Tell.
Okay. Well, I feel that right now, I'm sure everybody is aware of all the strange things going on right now. You know, the earth is going through some huge transformations.
Right.
And I know we're all feeling it. We're probably feeling the headaches, the restlessness, can't sleep, can't concentrate. Well, the earth is increasing her vibration, and it's affecting all of us. And right now we've had the sinkholes all over the world. We've had some major earthquakes going on. Since 2011, they've just been increasing. And
I forget the department of the government he's with, but he's basically the guy who knows about fires and
mm-hmm.
he said that the fires that are increasing
right.
exponentially are it's just incredible, you know, the size of them and how many and we have the ice caps melting and there's something
right.
wrong with the waters in the ocean and the tsunamis
mm-hmm.
and the hurricanes are more powerful and look what just happened in Oklahoma
right.
with those earthquakes and I mean it's
right,
just on
Karen.
And on and on. Yeah.
Right. Everything. It's, you know, there's strange sounds that are being heard and flashes of light that people are seeing. And then there's shaking going on that the USGS says is not related to any earthquake activity. And I believe that's all part of what's going on within the Earth's core. The Earth core is changing. It's that's why these weird things, and even our weather is changing because of what's going on with the wobble of the earth. And we're being warned. Mother Earth is telling us, you know, she's changing. She's going to go through a huge transformation, and so are we.
Well, you know, anybody who's watched Ancient Aliens or some of these other
mm-hmm.
shows, I mean, you know, Atlantis has disappeared, and, you know, we wonder
right.
if there weren't other cultures that were lost to the sands of time. I mean, you have that geologist
mm-hmm.
who says that the Sphinx is really water eroded and 10,000 years old, which would throw
right.
the whole timeline off.
Yeah, right.
I mean, there's so many things. But let's go back to what you think you know, or maybe you've been told. I mean, those are things we can all witness, things that are happening.
Mm-hmm.
But have you gotten any message or intuitive sense of why? I mean, is this just sort of a natural evolution? Is it because of the man-made, you know, pollution? Is this are the aliens watching to see what's happening? what can you tell us?
All the above, Karen. All the above. Absolutely. We've got many beings watching us right now. Many that are watching what's going to happen. I think they know the future. Many of these beings have come here to warn us, but they have been watching us for eons. And I think some of them are here. They're benevolent beings that are helping us and guiding us. And I think, you know, that meteor that just barely missed that town in Russia this past February.
Yeah.
Well, I woke up in the middle of the night with a message that these asteroids that have been coming really close to Earth, that they have shielded the Earth, and they're protecting us from a lot of these things coming in. And we're going to see a lot more of this meteor activity and asteroids coming through, because I think there is something large. You know, people have talked about Planet X out there, and, you know, there's no proof that it exists, but, you know, it makes you wonder if it does come through our solar system every 3,600 years and pulls in all this space debris with it, and when it gets too close to Earth, it starts causing the earth to do, you know, go through its transformation. And of course, we have all the other planets out there that are doing very strange things.
Well, you know, I hadn't heard about the Planet X theory. But you know, so that's a new one. You know,
really?
And also too, you know, well, there's, you know, people talking about the chemtrails and HAAR.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's so many things. You know, you wonder.
Oh,
if,
I know.
I mean, look, I'm not afraid of a conspiracy theory. You know, I'm really not, because I nothing would surprise me. I mean, aliens could land on the White House lawn, and I'd just go, yeah, so what? You know. I just wouldn't be shocked at almost anything, because I guess I just feel like there's so much we don't know, and I think we're crazy if we think we do know it all.
Oh, exactly. There's just so many things out there. You know, every day I read something new that's been uncovered, or a new theory about something, you know, giants that existed on our planet. You know, we've got Bigfoot, and there's just too many stories and legends about Bigfoot not to believe that it exists. You know, there's just too much.
Floods. I mean, the floods we've had through history,
sure.
And all different people have the floods and their creation stories.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
I mean, and how do we have pyramids, you know, all around the world? And these,
right.
I mean, these structures that couldn't possibly have been built by primitive people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's
right.
just, I mean, those are the things, those sorts of tangible things are, I think, what tend to convince me that, I mean, I just don't believe ancient people had the wherewithal. You know, that we might have been more talented than we know, but, I mean, we couldn't duplicate that now. So, anyway, I'm digressing. What I really want to know, Betsy, is angels, ETs, are they the same thing or are they different?
Well, they are different. I believe in angels, and I know that I've been warned many, many times of events that are coming or things that were going to happen, and I know that's my guardian angels. I believe we all have guardian angels, and I believe many of these beings have never been incarnated into a physical body. Of course, I believe also that there are aliens that have disguised themselves as religious figures, like in Fatima, Portugal, when the three children had their vision of a Marian vision. It began May 13th of 1917 through October 13th, 1917. And she came to him always on the 13th. She would come in a puff of smoke. Sometimes there was large booms that were heard. She would always come at solar noon when she appeared to them. And no one else could see her, just the three children. But there was just a lot of strange, I would call it theatrics. And the last event was on October 13th, 1917, when 70 to 80,000 people saw what looked like the sun fall from the sky and spin on its axis and just spin wildly. And they thought, you know, they were all doomed, that the earth was doomed when this happened. And there was just incredible colors that were spread around. But what's interesting, only people within a 14-mile radius of Fatima saw this event. There wasn't one astronomer around the world that saw anything unusual about the sun that day. But what they described, get this, they described it as a plate of silver. It made strange and abrupt movements outside the cosmic laws. It was a very clear disk. It gleamed. It had a sharp edge to it. It looked like a plate of dull silver. Does that sound like the sun to you?
No. So you're thinking this was an ET, a female
yes.
ET, I guess, or an
yes.
ET that could take the shape of a benevolent-looking woman.
Right. And I believe that this ET or celestial being knew the future, because she made predictions about World War I, World War II. She predicted two of the youngest children, which were cousins of Lucia, were going to die young, which they did from the Spanish flu. which decimated, it killed 50 to 100 million people during that time. And Lucia lived, of course, to be 95. She died February 13th, 2005. And there's something about that number 13.
Right.
And, you know, I've found some very strange things about number 13 that I think has been warnings to us about the number 13th, and it has to do with a solar event.
Well, now, wasn't there a third prophecy that the Vatican kept under wraps?
Right. It was supposed to have been released in 1961, and the church, the Vatican.
Was it ever released?
No. No. So, some people have thought that, you know, it had to do with World War II or with the attempted assassination on Pope John Paul. And that was on the 13th day. That was May 13th, 1981. But still many think that whatever they saw, what they were shown some event that was so catastrophic that the children were just terribly frightened when it happened, I guess, when they saw this vision. But I think it really does have to do with a solar event because of what they were shown on the last day and why she always appeared at solar noon. And, of course, there's been some other things that have happened on the 13th, which has to do with ETs. So I believe we've been warned. And if you'd like
if
me
you
to go
to
into
predict,
that, I'll be
Betsy, I mean, if you had to predict, I mean, it seems like time is not linear with these things that have happened, you know.
No, it's not.
So, I mean, I would imagine that makes it sort of hard to predict if you, you know, if you think something catastrophic is going to happen when it might actually be.
Well, I believe we can change timelines. I believe that when we come together in mass, and a good example of that was when Apollo 13, you know, when those astronauts almost, you know, died in outer space out there, when everything went wrong and, you know, the catastrophic things were going on, and the world prayed. They came together. And I think we changed the timeline. I think the harmonic convergence, when people came together and prayed all around the world, and this is before the Internet, that, you know, we changed the timeline that way. And, of course, I believe, like you said, time is not linear. The past, present, future are all happening at once. And there's many, many theories about that. Physicists believe, you know, that it's quite possible, and they've done experiments that show that time is not linear.
So what would that mean in a practical sense?
In a practical sense, that we can change timelines. We can change events. And, you know, we think we're so helpless sometimes. You know, now, let's say that there is an asteroid headed towards us. I think that we can change that. I think Earth does have to go through certain changes right now because we can't continue on this path that we're on right now. You know, the planet is dying. And, you know, I know we don't want to face that, but it is. And look what's going on. It's just incredible. Our waters are being destroyed. They're polluted, you know, Fukushima and what happened with Fukushima. And there's still radiation out there and all the tons of debris that's in the ocean and plastics. And
right,
then we
right.
have the
Yeah, there's
Gulf
a lot to contend with, absolutely.
Yes, of course.
So
you know, it's not getting better.
Well, let's jump over to the Phoenix Lights. What do you think the Phoenix Lights was about?
Ah, I love the Phoenix Lights. March 13th, 1997. The event included thousands of people. In fact, they were out that night because they were looking for Hale-Bopp, the comet. And thousands of people were looking up in the sky. And what they saw was a parade of low-flying mile-wide V-shaped formations of orbs and craft that were gliding overhead. And the event was hailed as probably the largest mass sighting of UFOs in modern times. And witnesses to the event later reported positive changes in their life with clarity of thought, concentration, and a dramatic sense of love and connectedness to family. And meanwhile, the military was saying that, you know, they were dropping flares. Now, I don't know how you can get that kind of feeling with flares, do you?
Well, not only that, but, I mean, some of the stuff they say is so absurd. I mean, if you're dropping flares, how, you know, these lights were suspended up there in a very uniform shape for a long period of time, and they move.
Right.
Flares don't act like that. How stupid do they think we are?
Well, they do. You know, we've heard swamp gas for UFOs.
right.
You know, ridiculous things like that. It's just ludicrous. And, you know, people don't buy into that. We're smarter than that. But, you know, the UFO event actually started, I guess, in northern Arizona and moved all the way down to to Mexico. And people all over the state actually saw this event. It was amazing. And I think Phoenix was selected, and I talked to Dr. Lynn Kaiti, who was a witness to the massive UFO sighting. She was on my show. And she thought Phoenix was selected, too, because Phoenix was named after the mythical bird, which rises up, you know, which sets itself on fire and is reborn again. So the rebirth, the death, the rebirth. And it's also linked to the sun, which is interesting. The phoenix is, you know, part of the sun, too. The
mythology we keep going back to the sun.
Right.
But do we have a good theory about, I mean, was this just, hi, I'm here, you know, we're really here? You know, those you know, feelings of, you know, those feel-good kind of things that happened as a result, you know, that was that just sort of a side effect of their presence, or we don't really know. We're just sort of all guessing.
We are all guessing. We are. But everyone felt this clarity of thought. So something was being transmitted symbolically in mass to the people that had witnessed that. And
Subliminal mass subliminal message or something.
Absolutely. And I think many people that have been abducted that have a memory loss I think we're all going to awaken someday, maybe on the same day, the same time, and we'll just go, I get it. I know what it's all about, you know. We're all going to say, of course. You know, this is the message.
So switching gears here, let's sort of hopscotch from one thing to another. So apparently there's a theory that Japan was warned by ETs about the tsunami and the... Tell us a little bit about that quickly.
Okay. Well, that took place on March 11th, 2011. And what was really strange, it started out in January. The strange things started really happening. Birds were dropping dead out of the sky. Millions of fish were washing up on shores around the world. And there was no explanation for it. And I kept thinking it's methane gases being released deep within the Earth's core. And something is going to happen. A major earthquake is going to happen somewhere. And there was a lot of strange earthquakes around that time, but a lot of people started seeing UFOs all over the place, over major cities and over Japan during that time. So I think it was a warning. I think we're always warned before major events if we just listen, either Mother Earth, you know, the animals, both feral and domestic animals, warn us when something's going to happen. I think we have the celestial UFO beings are always warning us, too. So all we have to do is just trust our intuition, you know.
Right.
Watch
right.
for these signs.
Well, but we
They're
feel
there.
Silly. You know, we feel silly when we do, you know.
We do. I know we do.
So now in your book you talk about several UFO abduction cases that you think were hoaxed. Why? Why would they do that? I mean, that would just sort of, you know, discredit the whole, you know, the whole movement.
Well, for money, for attention, for fame.
Right.
You know,
right.
Why do people do anything? But there are some very credible, I think, some wonderful stories like Betty and Barney Hill. They never wanted the fame. They never wanted the attention. They, you know, they were an interracial couple, so they just didn't want the
attention. Yeah.
They didn't. You know, they didn't want the publicity about it. They were very quiet about it. And, of course, a book was written about them, but they didn't write it. And Betty did, after her husband died, did make many, you know, she did make several interviews after that. But some of these people, like Betty Andreasen, Luca, is one of the most interesting cases, I think, written by Raymond Fowler in his book The Watchers 1 and Watchers 2. And what's really interesting, I was talking about the phoenix. She was shown a giant phoenix, and she said it was a holographic recreation of death and rebirth. And these ETs seem to have a little insignia on their outfits of a phoenix. So what does the phoenix mean to the aliens? There's something about the phoenix that, you know, is a part of their religion, maybe. Who knows? But isn't it interesting that just about every culture around the world has a phoenix bird? Either it's called a thunderbird, the Bennu bird, but it's, you know, there is a phoenix.
Right. Well, now jumping over to the cattle mutilations, which are always seems to be associated with ETs, are you thinking ET or are you thinking military or government experiments?
Well, when I was doing my investigations and I was collaborating with a gentleman in Paris, Texas, who was doing a quarterly report, and he would actually go out on some of these cases and investigate them, and he felt that it was military because of all the areas that it was in. It was close to a military base, a lot of unmarked helicopters were seen in the area. And what he
felt. But what would be the point? I mean, if they wanted cow innards, they wouldn't have to steal, you know, the rancher's cattle.
Right. Well, one theory is that they've been putting some kind of biological, you know, substance out there in the air, and, of course, it's going through the animals and, of course, us, too, of course. But, you know, this way they can tell what's going on with the animals. So they mark them. They've found infrared markings on these animals, and at night they can find these animals that they pick out. They can airlift them somewhere, do their experiments, and then airdrop them, because most of these animals have been airdropped when they find them, and that's why there's no blood, because the blood has been drained from whatever location they took them from, which is interesting. But I do think that in a few cases there are ETs that have helped the military with their experiments, their nefarious experiments, whatever those are. And, you know, it's interesting that our government has done so many experiments on citizens without their knowledge through the years, you know, going back into the 40s, the 50s, the 60s.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm thinking of the Tuskegee Airmen and the syphilis experiments. I mean, you know, who trusts the government, you know? I mean.
Oh, right. I know. Just look at it.
Well, so Betsy, we probably have about 15 minutes left. So I guess what I want to get at is, you know, I'm reading some of the materials from the publicist, and what I didn't, let's go back to, you know, the abductions. I'm seeing here that Ann Druffel regressed you and your mother. Was the, you know, what was uncovered in those sessions?
Well, my mother was. She was under hypnosis first, and I was not allowed to hear it at the time because Ann didn't want me to, you know, have, you know, any, she just didn't want me to hear any of that, so I would be influenced by what she said. But when I heard it later, she was just terrified that there was something out there. And she thought there was a horse that ran in front of them. And then she talked about a plane for a moment, and then she said it disappeared. So maybe she was seeing a UFO, but she kept telling my father not to roll down the window, that there was something out there that was going to get them. Mm-hmm. And she was frightened that something was going to take me. In fact, she talked about how she had dreams, nightmares, that someone was taking me. And what's really interesting is that when I went under regression, I saw that we were actually abducted by a great big UFO that hovered over us, and we were actually beamed aboard. Now, that sounds really like Star Trek, right? Beam me aboard,
yeah.
Scotty. But, you know, Travis Walton and many people have talked about that, if we can believe those cases, that there is a beam of light that they use, and they can beam people aboard. And a lot mm-hmm. of these cattle mutilations, these cattle have been beamed aboard. They've seen this brilliant red light that actually lifts them right up into the craft. And I describe that. I describe my mother being in a tube-like structure calling for me. She couldn't find me. And I was on some kind of a table, and I felt that they injected something into my neck. And it's funny, I talked to someone else that felt that they were abducted and had the same thing, and I've never heard that, having something injected in the neck. And
unless they're like pulling out spinal fluid or something.
Maybe.
Extraction mm-hmm. rather than a injection.
Right.
But it seems like all of this, and I'm not saying this to diminish your experiences, but it's
no.
But whether you're because you know I it would not surprise me at all to hear that this all happened to you, and
mm-hmm.
I guess what I'm saying though is nothing, you know, whether it's your dreams or the abductions and the regressions and the messages, nothing is clear cut. Everything is still has a vagueness
yes.
about
of
it.
Of course, and that's the way it is with everyone that's been abducted. There's that nebulous part about it that we just don't understand. Except, you know, I can't deny that I have had these dreams that do come true. I've been warned over and over about earthquakes. I knew about Mount St. Helens erupting before it happened. Earthquakes before they happen. I have dreams, or I have headaches. My mother and I had many of the classic characteristics of abductees, which is the nosebleeds, feeling paralyzed, scoop-shaped scars on us, missing time, affecting
yeah.
electronic equipment, fear of doctors, insomnia.
Well, I know this is kind of putting you on the spot, and I don't mean
you can.
To. All right. So what? You know, what do you think is going to happen next, and how soon? Is it possible for you to even answer?
Yes, I can. May 13th of this year, we had 4 major X-class flares. That was the day and the month that the children first saw the Marian apparition in Fantoma, which I think is no coincidence. And I think something's going to happen in October, because that was her last visit. And I may be wrong, but I'm just sensing that something is going to happen on or near October 13th of this year. And of course, we've had all. Beg your pardon?
Were these 13th Fridays, or no, not necessarily?
No, they weren't. No.
Okay.
No. But we've had, there's been some major crop circles that appeared on the 13th. There was one that was reported on August 13th, 2001, which was the largest UK crop circle ever seen. And, of course, there was 409 individual circles that formed a spiral pattern, which 409 equals 13. It adds up to 13.
And so what do you think the crop circles are about? I mean, and do you think they're made by aliens?
Oh, I think it is a highly evolved intelligence. I don't know if you'd call them ETs or interdimensional or, I don't know, celestial beings, but I know that they're trying to tell us something, and I think it's been telling us about an event coming. I think we're being told all over and over about what's going on with the sun and with the earth and...
Well, I
maybe
wish they
even
would speak more clearly.
I know. I wish they would just spell it out, don't you?
Well, yeah.
I mean, just tell
I mean,
us.
Because, I mean,
know. We're playing these games.
Imagine. Would it, I mean, forgive me. I don't know what your politics are. But if we had some celestial being, especially if they look like mm-hmm. an angel, for the benefit of
right.
all the Christians and Republicans in this in this country, if something said, look, you've been wrong about climate change, get your shit
right.
together and quit destroying the earth, you know,
uh-huh.
maybe something like, I mean, I'm saying instead of these vague things that, you know, don't
know.
Give us a definitive answer, if
I
these
know.
Beings really want to help us, then,
mm-hmm.
you know, they need to be clearer with their message.
I agree totally. But, you know, there's just a lot of strange things going on, like I said, out there. And, of course, the Catholic Church has sent several of the astronomers have made different remarks about ETs. There's Father Balducci, and there's several of the astronomers. There was Father Gabriel Funes said that intelligent beings could be out in outer space. And you know, it seems like they know something. And I've always felt that the church knew something that's going to happen. And
well,
of course
they have
they
all
built,
the secret information they hide in the Vatican vault. But,
mm-hmm.
but I mean, yeah, when they came out and said, proof of aliens would not mean there is no God, or whatever that was.
I
thought right then and there that they did maybe know something, you know, because why else would they say something like that?
And
you
why
know?
Did they help build that huge telescope near Tucson on Mount Graham, which was a holy place for the Apaches down there? They took that beautiful mountain from them, and they won't give it back. But, of course, they built their telescope up there, and they've been watching something out there. And of course, they call it Lucifer, which is, isn't
That's
that strange?
Funny.
Well, it stands for Large Binocular Telescope Near Infrared Utility and Camera Intra-Field Unit for Extragalactic Research.
Okay.
yeah, sure. Right. But they're watching for something out there. And Father Martin, it was Malachi Martin, talked about it, that he knew that they were watching for Planet X. So can we believe that? I don't know. I think so. I think there's something going on out there. And this new pope, he's got a lot of 13s involved in his life, too. I call him Pope 13, and I know we're running out of time, but perhaps sometime I could talk to you about that. Interesting.
Well, 13, I mean, do we know why 13, other than 13 just keeps popping up and we don't know why?
Well, 13, according to Pythagoras, who was a Greek philosopher, said that numbers had souls, and he believed that they had mystical powers. And 13, you know, has always been associated with bad luck, too, but it's also a number of creation. It's just a power number. And I think it's also a date. You know, of course, the Illuminati is supposed to be associated with the number 13 too, which is kind of interesting.
Yeah,
so.
And it seems like it's all about light too, doesn't it? Light and well, one final question, Betsy, there's a provocative question here on your talking points. Do you think there's an evil cabal who wants to destroy the planet, and if so, what will prevent them from taking over the planet? What do you think about that?
I do. I think this is a free will planet. I think that we have a choice. There are people out there that want to destroy us, and I think the leaders out there are not the people we think they are. I think that they have an agenda for us. And it's a power agenda. I think many of them don't care if they destroy our planet, which is very strange. But
that makes perfect sense to me. I mean, the ones who want the end times to come, and you know, the ones that don't think that they can live in their in their little walled communities while the rest of us starve, you know, with their austerity measures. I mean, that I all believe. You know, I think there's no empathy. You know, they're devoid of compassion.
Well, look into their eyes. Look into their eyes, because the eyes are the windows of the soul. And what do you see in some of these people's eyes? I see a cold, dark, steely eyes, shark eyes that have, like you said, no compassion. They're just cold.
Sort of dead and ignorant,
as if
what they do to the planet, they somehow will not be, that it won't touch them some kind of a way,
right?
You know,
right.
Could I say
something real quick? That,
oh, absolutely.
There are rumors, and of course, former Governor Jesse Ventura investigated these underground bunkers that they're building all across the United States under the Denver airport, and there's something going on in the Ozarks. There's just some amazing things going on. So why are they building these underground bunkers? They're getting ready for something.
Interesting. I mean, I've watched him occasionally, and nothing ever seemed to be definitive, and it sort of got frustrating. But I didn't know about the underground bunkers. They actually showed them on television. It wasn't just somebody talking about them without proof.
Right. Okay. There is some. They've talked to people that were helping build the underground area for right underneath the Denver airport. There's just some very strange things there. In fact, there's a plaque that says that it was built by the New World Order.
Seriously,
yes.
Okay, I'm
going
to have to Google that.
Yes, you'll be amazed what's in there. And there's some very dark things in there. There's even a gargoyle in a suitcase there. You know, it's like a little statue thing on the side of the wall.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, you know, some of these things sound far out, but some of them are within the realm of my believability.
I know. Check it out.
So, Betsy, I think I'm going to have to close with asking you, I know we tried to cover a lot in a short period of time. Is there anything I didn't ask you that you wanted to make sure you tell listeners?
Yes. Well, I know you have a lot of feminine listeners out there, and I just want to say trust your intuition. Women use their right brain, and we are so intuitive. It's part of our DNA. So with all these earth changes, just trust what's going on and listen to watch, you know, reconnect with Mother Earth. It's so important that we do that, you know, trust her and what she's telling us. And I know we'll be fine. Just human up out there. We're going to be fine.
I like that. Human up.
Human up.
Human up. That's a good one. Instead of these callous bastards who don't act like they're human at all.
That's right. That's right. Oh, thank you, Karen. It's been great fun.
Well, Betsy, thank you so much for coming on. And promise me that if you get some sort of premonition or message, or when it gets close to October, will you remind me to pay attention around the 13th, or come back on the show, and if you get more info that you want to share?
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to. Thank you so much.
Okay, you're welcome. Thank you so much. Good night.
Mm-hmm. Good night.
Well, listeners, I think that was fun. What about you? I'm going to be watching around the 13th of October. I'll tell you for sure. Anyway, we are about out of time, and I just have some quick last-minute announcements. Speaking of October, please remember to save the date, Sunday, October 6th. Pagan Pride Day at the Rainbow Lagoon Park in Long Beach. Pagan Pride is a place for pagans to gather to socialize, network, and shop, a place where people who are new to the community can make connections and new friends. It provides the opportunity to learn from respected teachers in our community. It's a place to connect with each other and divine source from different paths. During ritual, it's a chance to meet and talk to your favorite authors. It's a showcase for pagan-related entertainment, and it's a venue for organizations to connect with the community. For more information, go to paganpridela.org. They can always use volunteers. They can always use donations. You might want to be a vendor. You might want to give a talk. You might want to perform. Pagan Pride Day, Long Beach, California, October 6th. And as I close tonight's show, I want to ask you to tune in next week after the 4th of July holiday. I'll have two shows. On Monday of next week, I'll have Susan Hawthorne with me discussing the politics of patriarchy in academia. She's calling in from Australia. Followed by Sabina Magliocco discussing what is pagan fundamentalism. Then on Wednesday, yes, next week, I actually have two shows on Monday and Wednesday. On Wednesday, James Olson is with me discussing his book, The Whole Brain Path to Peace: The Role of Left and Right Brain Dominance in the Polarization and Reunification of America. And my second guest on Wednesday will be Polly Campbell, discussing her book, Imperfect Spirituality: Extraordinary Enlightenment for Ordinary People. So remember, you can catch the show from the archives anytime or listen via iTunes as well. And in closing tonight, I'd like to remind you of the motto of the show in the words of Gandhi. I think it's kind of appropriate for everything we normally talk about, and maybe even what Betsy had to talk about. First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. You know, who knows what we will find out in the future? Who knows what will be the new normal? I sure am keeping an open mind. But anyway, I would like to invite you to go to my Examiner column. I have some new articles there, one I just put up today about freedom and independence for the 4th of July. Do women really have freedom with this war on women that's being waged by Republicans? Do we really have freedom with this war on, democracy and voting rights and workers and immigrants? It's really a shame when you think about it. You know, this country is supposed to be about justice and equality and human rights, and there are so many people out there that would take that away from other people because we don't have the same God, because we don't look the same, because we have different traditions. Goddess is the poster girl for diversity, and we all live under a big tent. It's just a shame everyone doesn't think that. So please go to my Examiner column or email me if you can't find it. I will send you a link. But thank you so much for tuning in. As always, you are gas in my tank. You keep me going. Keep the emails coming. Keep the story ideas and the guest ideas coming. I have a wonderful 4th of July holiday. If you can, put aside all the ugliness in the news for a few days and just enjoy your family, enjoy your loved ones. And we will resume the battle when we get back. We will continue being uppity women fighting for equality and our rights. Yes, we will. So I will close the show with just a little bit of Yemaya by Lane Redman. And again, remember, please keep her in your prayers. Good night.
Mama.